From the heart of the Oregon wine country, you're listening to Season 7 of the Wine Crush Podcast. Stories uncorked for wine enthusiasts around the world, featuring winemakers from the Willamette Valley and beyond. Sponsored by Country Financial. From origin stories to terroir, here's your host, Heidi Moore.
Hey everybody, it is Wine Crush time, and this is going to be a special one because we have Eugenie Keegan with us, one of my favorite people, legend. There's so many different adjectives that we can add to your name that just makes you amazing. So Eugenie Keegan from Jackson Family Wines has joined us, and it's going to be a full hour of greatness. So hold on to your seats.
Yeah.
Pour yourself a lovely large glass of wine. And according to Eugenia, you can pour it at anything you want. Jelly jar, glass.
As long as there's only one hole.
As long as there's only one hole and you can drink out of it, then it's a good vessel to go. So Eugenia, with that, let's cheer with some bubbles that you brought us.
Let's
and
do it.
Start it off the right way.
Good afternoon, Heidi.
Okay. Let's, I forgot to drink it. Mm. We got to do that too. Mm-hmm.
It makes the conversation go that much easier.
Oh, it does. And oh my God, those are so, so good. So you should always start an event out with a glass of bubbles.
Mm-hmm. It's really why we decided to make bubbles in the first place. It was, where's the opening wine? Where's the opening act?
That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, it's always bubs.
Instead of a great opening band, you have a bottle of bubbles that starts the whole party off with a big old shebang.
Exactly. Exactly. With all of the celebration that sparkling wine reminds you of.
I got it. Yeah. I got it. From here on out.
From here on out.
Bubbles all the time, which is never a bad idea.
No, never.
No.
No.
Whether it's baby showers or Friday night or whatever it is, it's time for—
Dare I say Wednesday morning?
Yes. Yes.
Yes.
Wednesday morning for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. You can always stop by my office. Yes. Eugenie,
doors usually open around 9.
Doors usually open around 7:30 or 8. And yeah, apparently we're going to have bubbles every day now. So, okay, let's get into it because I am excited to talk to you. And you and I had spoken, you'd come into the office a few weeks ago and we planned, I think, being 30 minutes, ended up being probably close to 2 hours.
I would say 2 hours.
Just chit-chatting and yapping and sharing stories and having such a great time. So let's start kind of childhoodish, you know, where all this interest in wine initiated and started and has now increased into where you're at right now.
Yeah, no, that's a very long story. So we're going to try and shorten that one up.
Let's hit the good spots.
Let's hit the good spots. But it was fun in our chat because I think we found our mutual love of agriculture because that's how you grew up and that's how I grew up. And it was really hanging out with my grandfather, Eugene, for whom I'm named. And I spent a lot of time with him and my grandmother when I was young. And we got up every day and we went out and it was the ranch in Sonoma County was a perfect example of agriculture in Western Sonoma County, from cattle to hops to beans to prunes or apples, depending upon where you were, and then finally to grapes. And so when I was growing up, we were in the middle of some of that. We had hops when I was young, we had beans, we had, and certainly prunes and ultimately grapes. So I grew up in that milieu with my grandfather, and I didn't understand what it meant to me when I was growing up. It just was, until I went off more to school and started to get into college. And I took a year off in college and started bummed around Europe. Very normal thing to do at that time, to take a year off and get your backpack and put your thumb out and go around Europe on $5 a day.
It's the best thing.
It's the best
Not
thing.
Not that I probably encourage the thumb no,
for
rides anymore.
No, I would discourage that highly.
But just that year off to go enjoy Europe.
Yeah,
specifically.
Changed my whole life.
I would say it changed mine too. I didn't thumb rides either, but spent a lot of time in the UK, and it has completely opened my eyes to definitely life outside of Oregon.
Yeah, that's right, outside of the United States. I had a great aunt who was the most generous human being on the face of the planet. And so when I got ready to go, she bought for me for every month, she would re-up my first class train ticket. So I would sleep on the trains. On a first-class train, there's nobody on that train at 11 o'clock at night. And I'd go from point A to point B on an overnight train. And I'd just pull the sort of the seats down, and which would come to be a bed, and you'd close off the curtains, and I would just sleep there. And when I was doing this on $5 a day, it was really, really helpful. So it changed my life. And part of it was, in all that travel, I spent a lot of time in the country, and I didn't really understand that there's a certain part of agriculture that becomes life. I grew up with it, but I didn't see how it affected me. And it was in Europe where I really understood how grapes transformed into wine, not the chemistry of it, the concept of it, and that it became a whole lifestyle on the farm with the family around food, and that you could be self-sustained on a small farm. And this was the early 70s, and we were getting back to the land. And it was just this image that this could exist. And remember, at this time in California, this was California, there were just a handful of wineries. There was no industry as we understand it today.
That's a really good point, because when you say wine in the U.S., people just assume that Sonoma and Napa and all of that has existed from day one. I mean, it's the only history that they know is that California is wine country. It's probably been in existence since way before the Mayflower. And that's just is not the case.
It's just not the case. And in fact, the first wines were made in Ohio, and they're growing grapes. And as you can imagine, that was a fertile valley. And right now, all 50 states make wine. It's not an impossible thing. But in terms of an industry, it obviously was California. It still is in terms of the bulk of what goes on. But it was in the mid-60s when Robert Mondavi started the Robert Mondavi Winery. And I can never remember if it's 65 or 66, but nonetheless, same David Lett planted Pinot Noir up here, 65, 66, as did Chuck Curry. And that's the very beginning of what was going on here on the West Coast, was 65, 66.
That's just not that far ago.
No.
I mean, it may be because I was born in 1974, and so that's kind of part of my wheelhouse, I guess, so to speak, but it's just not that far ago.
Right. It's not like being in Europe where it's thousands of years of history.
Yes.
And it's just it's such an inextricable part of everyday life over there. And that's just not the way it is here.
I wish it was.
Me too.
And I actually just told my sister yesterday, and actually to the shock of my husband's face, when I told him that I wanted to buy a little chateau or villa in Europe somewhere, my sister's like, yes, let's do it. And my husband's like, oh my God, she might be serious.
She might be serious.
But I love the lifestyle of going to a small town or a village. And like our last guest had talked about, Mark within France, is like, you walk to the market, you walk to the bakery, you grab a glass of wine, you know, these cobblestone streets have this whole energy and history to them that in the United States, we just don't understand. There's a quiet and a solace of life and a slowed down pace in most parts over there that we need to grab onto and hold tight.
Couldn't agree more. It's what attracted me to it, was this idea that you would sit down and have lunch. You would have worked hard all morning, get up early, work hard, and then you sit down. And my grandfather practices, and he'd always have a beer with lunch, occasionally a glass of wine, but mostly beer. But then he'd take a nap after lunch, and he'd get up, and then he'd go about his late afternoon, evening business. But this sense that it's not about getting to the finish line. There is no finish line except death. So
don't want to hurry that along.
We don't want to hurry that along. No. So it's about just savoring each and every day and every sunrise and every sunset. There's just a different sense of the pace of life. And like you, I find it very attractive, and I wish we would grab on to it. I think it would support our goals for wellness in a really strong way.
Oh, 1,000,000% agree. I mean, just that slowed down pace of being able to take a deep breath and not wonder what the next task was that you had to hurry into. I mean, I'm the queen of that, ADD to all extents. And when I find that I'm over there, or even like a Hawaiian life, mm-hmm. everything is on its own pace and there's just no hurry. And you can savor the wine and you can savor the cheese or just the conversations that you're having, wherever you're having them. It's just, it really is life-changing.
The task at hand will be there in a half an hour.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yep. So with all your traveling in Europe at that age, I don't know why you came back. it would have been,
I don't either.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't disagree at all with that thinking. And I guess I was too young to think about settling there on my own. I mean, I wasn't out of college yet, so I hadn't ever established a household of my own and that sort of thing. I think that might have been it. It's too bad I didn't run into somebody that said, let's rent a house and, I just start down that pathway. But it didn't happen. And I tell young people all the time, look, you're going to get into a job and you're going to get into a mortgage and hopefully a solid relationship. And at the end of the day, you can't just get up and leave those things. So now's the time before you make any of those commitments and you have those commitments, take all the time that you can to go explore the rest of the world. And particularly in the wine business, you can do internships in the vineyards and in the wineries, which is what I did in France. And you get room and board and you get to do all this learning and meet all these people. And there are professional interns. For 10 years, they'll do it. And they'll have 20 different experiences during those 10 years. And then they finally settle down. But it's the time to go do that. I didn't get to do that again until I was almost 50 years old. No, almost 60 years old, I think.
Yowza.
No, maybe 50.
We'll go with 50.
It's a good 50. Number. Go with 50.
Yeah.
They're so far behind me now. They're all just mushed together into one big number. Earlier. Yeah.
Earlier in life.
Yeah.
Working that internship in France, was that kind of where you caught the wine bug to actually make wine and be part of the industry? Or did it take coming back to Sonoma to hit that stride?
My grandfather was a grower only, so the idea of making wine had not really occurred to me. So yes, that was solidified when I was on this trip, that was the added value. It wasn't just growing the grapes. It wasn't just creating this beautiful agricultural product. More importantly, it was turning it into something spectacular, a bottle of wine. And there's only one thing to do with a bottle of wine, and that is share it with people and food. I mean, that's its whole purpose in life.
Oh.
And so that became then my purpose in life.
It's a great purpose.
Thank you.
I mean, you're sharing with us today.
Thank you. And here we are doing exactly the same thing 50 years later.
Yes. It's, and to be said, with like the whole internship, especially being in France and Europe, you get fed really well.
Oh yeah, it's all room and board.
Oh my God.
And they can't pay you. They're not legally allowed to pay you. So different than here where we can't have free labor, we can only have paid labor. They can have free labor because it's family and that sort of thing.
Sure.
And yes, it's room and board and hanging out with a like-minded group of people, often from all over the world. And you're all young and, can go hard because you go hard all day. And so you can go hard all night. It's just,
yep.
That's just what the age gets you. I remember it well.
Yeah. Surviving off maybe an hour or two of sleep then getting up and doing it all over again.
Correct.
And still looking like you don't look like shit and you don't maybe like even feel like it either. And pop right back out.
Take a shower and get your hair all wet and everything and you're back out there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It might be tough that afternoon, but it gets done.
That's where that siesta comes in.
That's exactly.
Maybe a quick little power nap in the
exactly,
corner.
Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. Yeah. So it was a moving experience. And yes, it set the trajectory for my whole life after that. I came back. I finished school with my mother thought as soon as I went away, I'd never come back and finish college. I came back with a purpose. I finished school as quickly as I could because I was in San Diego and I needed to get back up to the Bay Area. And I went back up, finished at Berkeley and was literally out the door practically going to get a job.
Yeah. On fire, leaving college and starting a new life.
Yeah, getting ready to do something.
Was your college years, was that education in wine and enology and vineyard and all that
stuff? No. I have a degree in European history.
Of course you do.
I'm an expert in the Italian Risorgimento. Right, really.
Because you can use that in real world
all the time. I use it all the time. I talk about Garibaldi all the time. He's like,
I love Garibaldi. It's a great fishing town north of Tillamook.
Yeah. Right. That's so spot on. Yeah. But it did, because I had shifted my focus to Europe, I had to finish up and I was in history and I'm like, okay, we got to do something in European history. And I had spent a lot of time in that year in Italy and I became pretty good at Italian. So my minor's in Romance languages with an emphasis on Italian. And it all got wrapped up into sort of doing that. And really getting out of school was about finishing up as quickly as possible. so I could move on.
I now know who I'm taking to Italy with me, because you can speak the language and you can point me in the right direction and teach me history all at the same time.
All at the same time. And history is pretty rich over there.
It is. It's the one country I have not been to yet and need to definitely get there.
Yes, you do.
It's on the list.
You won't regret it.
High on the list.
Yeah.
Okay. We are back in California, out of school, been to Europe, caught the wine bug. So now what?
Well, I started by knocking on a few doors. I grew up in Sonoma County and had family relationships. And I, again, there were only 10 wineries there. It wasn't like there was a lot going on. And so I would go up, knock on their door and say, you know, free help. And in those days, nobody knew the rules. And so it was like, sure, you want to get on the bottling line or you want to go do this? So I sort of started that way, but that didn't pay the bills. So literally started working in wineries. I had a tasting room job, then I went in the cellar, and then I was in the vineyard for quite a while. I went back into the cellar, and pretty soon I ended up in senior management.
In California?
In California, righto.
Okay. So we go all over in California. And how do you manage to get up here?
Well, that's really a romance story, actually.
I love a great love story.
Yes, it is. That's a romance story. And it's kind of interesting because in 1994, or prior to that, I decided it was time to go out on my own and create my own brand. And I took the time to go all the way from Santa Barbara through the Willamette Valley looking for where I would start my own brand. And Oregon was very high on my list. I had a lot of friends in Oregon. There was a group called Pinot Noir America, which is a history for another day, but David Adelsheim was part of that. There was IPNC. So there was a lot of the Pinot Noir people from California, and there weren't a lot. They were from a little bit from Carneros, and Russian River wasn't even real yet. Russian River didn't have the name. Now it's one of the first AVAs that comes off your lips when you talk about New World Pinot. But then Russian River was nada. It grew Zinfandel as far as everyone was concerned. Anyway, I settled with Russian River primarily because that's where I grew up. And I already lived in the area. I didn't have to move. I had tons of relationships. And it took me 2 phone calls to get my first 4 tons of grapes and that sort of thing. And another phone call to figure out where I was going to make it and all of that. So it was very, very simple and straightforward to do it in my home territory. So I started that in 94, and I had that for 12 years.
And what was it called?
Keegan Cellars, my last name.
Oh, that makes a lot of sense.
Keegan Cellars. And along the way through these Pinot Noir organizations, et cetera, I got to know David Adelsheim. And I'm not sure it was love at first sight, but it was kind of love pretty quickly. And it was, who is this guy? You know, super smart and very serious, but not very warm. Very kind. And we ended up seeing each other on the road and blah, blah, blah. And we created a friendship. And we had Steamboat, which was a weekend conference that we had down in at the Steamboat Lodge. I think it's southeast of Eugene. And at some point, fast forward, and it turned out we were both at moments where we were uncoupled. And it was one of those things like, how's such and such? Oh, good. How's so and so? Oh, really? And that was it.
When you were in my office.
And that was at IPNC, by the way.
Yeah. When you were in my office, I had no idea that you and David Adelsheim were a thing.
Yeah, 25 years.
And you were so nonchalant about it, which, I mean, to you, he's David. He's your partner, your other half, whatever. And I didn't know anything about it. And so I was just listening, and you kept mentioning. And I think I finally stopped you, and I'm like, who is this David? Like, I think I have an idea of who this guy is, but who is it? And you said his name, and I'm like, oh.
Oh, that like, David.
That David. Yeah. Oh, my God. We got a power couple here. You know, how great is this?
It's quite fun.
Yeah. I can only imagine the conversations and the events and the antics and the things that you guys do as being such a passionate lover of wine and food, for that matter. And before I forget, you had mentioned we were talking about my dairy background and whatever.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, you totally love what we did for Christmas Eve. And I was expecting like a party or, you know, maybe a trip to the coast or whatever. You had a butter tasting contest.
Yeah. It was actually
who does that?
Well, it was actually New Year's Day, because you know how everybody starts a diet.
Oh, of course. So they say.
Right, right. Yeah. So we were going to be just totally the opposite. We're going to kick the year off with the right thing. And it's
with a pound of butter.
With a butter. Yeah. I don't know what they thought at the store when David bought like eight different, to your point, pounds of butter, different types of butter. Yeah, we had a butter taste off. And I told you the Tillamook came in number two.
I know it. I'm so proud.
You should be. It was so good.
Dairy farmers of Tillamook County.
Yeah.
Yeah. Quality control worldwide.
Yeah.
Because who was the winner? It was a French.
It was a butter from Normandy. And it has really high fat content.
Where do you buy something like that at? Costco?
No. Yeah. No. I want to say Provatory in Portland, but it might be. It might not be Provatory. I might have it not quite right. But
if you all have questions about where to buy French Normandy butter, send me a question.
Yeah. No, and I'll get it for you for sure. But it's a specialty food store in Portland. It's absolutely out of this world.
I need to find that.
Oh yeah, and I think that the baker in there is independent, and the meat person and the cheese person. So they're actually independent merchants inside this thing. It was kind of something like Pasta Works had done in the early days. And they have a wine shop there that's just fantastic. It's a great, great spot.
Oh my God. It sounds like I need to take like all my credit cards in there, and it's going to be very expensive.
Yes. Oh, and then they have some very unusual produce, and it's just super fun.
Huh. Okay.
Yeah.
Side note, that will be happening in the next couple of weeks.
Yeah.
Okay. Back to wine and the love story and how all of this happened.
So I didn't move up here as sort of an overnight thing. I did it over a period of time. And when I first was up here on a full-time basis, I needed to find an income, and I really didn't want to have my own brand. I didn't feel comfortable being in a room where I'm pouring my wine and Adelsheim is pouring their wine. It's like, no, I need to be part of Adelsheim, not doing my own thing. And I didn't have my own thing, so there was no reason to start it. If I had it,
sure,
it might be different.
It's like it's a cheap job, so it's like anybody can just start a winery.
Oh, anybody can start a winery. Yeah, anytime.
No, pennies out of the pocket.
Yeah, super, super easy. Yeah. No issue at all. I recommend everybody lose all their fortunes right away by going out tomorrow and starting a winery.
Ain't that true?
Ain't that true? Yeah. So I ended up starting a small fine wine distribution company based in Portland. And it was super fun because I actually had said to myself after 12 years of having Keegan Cellars, and I literally not only knew the name of every grapevine that I was tending, but, you know, I had friends, you know, amongst the little bacteria in the soil. And I mean, it was just like too micro everything. Micro geek. Let's call it micro geeky.
I've not heard that term, it's a good one.
I think it's the first time I termed it.
We're going to see your face in the dictionary next year as like the term of the year.
Micro geek.
Yes, yeah. Micro geek.
Micro geek. And so I realized that I got into this business because I fell in love with wine and I had lost some of my connection to the world of wine. So fine wine distribution, I'm like, this is great. I'll turn 180 degrees and I'll look out to what the rest of the world is doing. And, you know, it's evolving. I mean, we talk about Slovenia now. Well, we didn't talk about that 10 years ago. And there was a time when we didn't talk about Oregon. And we're just starting to talk about the UK as a place to make sparkling wine. Well, we didn't talk about that 10 years ago. So you go away for 10 years and it changes. So it was super fun to get into distribution. It's very hard, very, very hard business. But you basically are looking at wines from all over the world and then going back out all over the world. So that was a really fun period of time for us.
How eye-opening.
Yeah, it was a blast.
Oh my God. I mean, things that you will learn and the people that you'll meet, and
it's not even the
wine you'll drink. It's like
it's the people.
It's the culture and the people and the history and the food. And oh my God, that's the best thing about travel is the food and drink. And that's really one of the things that we look at, like when we choose destinations. Okay, what does the food and the culture look like? What does the drink of choice look like? Do we want to go there?
Yeah.
And if the answer is no to any of those, there's always something further down the list.
Yep.
Hence the reason why Italy's near the top of the list.
Yep. Yep. We were talking about some areas of travel that are super lovely and fun and very much about recreation and things like that, but they don't have a wine culture and they don't have a food culture in quite the same way.
Yeah.
That's not fair to say about a food culture, but it's not a food wine culture. It's a food other beverage culture.
Sure.
And that's super, but we're wine people. And so it's wonderful for a short period of time. But, you know, looking at second homes and places where you'd spend a lot of time, it's hard for us to imagine spending a lot of time, 3, 4, 2 months, a year, something like that, outside of a wine culture.
I agree anymore. And I would have never said that.
Yeah.
5 years ago, let alone 8 years ago when this whole wine thing for me started. But now it's like, you know, especially with my husband being, you know, enjoying the wine and being into it as well, is we want to look at the wine. And I don't want to go wine tasting the entire trip. Like when we were in Portugal, we did one day of wine stuff and that was good for us. But we could enjoy the wine of the culture while we were there. But I don't want to be in every single tasting room in the Douro.
Right. But every time you sit down at lunch, you experience a wine.
Oh, for sure.
At dinner, you experience a wine. So you get to experience their culture without just going to wineries, as you say.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of one a day, maybe two for a couple of days. But, you know, we're a little bit more focused on it. But it's much more fun when the trip's balanced.
Agreed. And, oh, my God, this Chardonnay is amazing.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Like, when I took the first drink of it, I'm like, oh, I need to say something, but we're not there yet.
We're not there yet.
Yes.
Yes.
And we're still not quite there yet.
Okay. Well, when we are, I'll give you the rundown.
Yeah. We're in the distribution mode. And that's how I initially had met you when I was in a class with Linfield. And you were talking about distribution through the class. And I'm like, oh, this lady is so fascinating. But I didn't know anything about you. I mean, you were the distribution lady and I knew you were something special, but I didn't really get it at the time until I kind of had gotten further into this. And so you're not really doing the distribution anymore. You actually got swept up by somebody else.
So I sold that company. But it was great because I did it for 6 years. It gave me something else to do in Oregon while David continued to do Adelsheim and be part of the industry and open up a whole other world for us in terms of travel and looking at all these other wines. And I know that he would say that were he speaking to you now, that was so fun because it reminded us that there's a whole world of wine out there. And we drink wine from all over the world every night. It's someplace different most of the time.
Yes. Let's talk about this little vineyard in France that you had told me about. Speaking of wine in different places.
Mine? My
yes,
little one?
Yes, yeah. Of course.
So let me get there then. I'll do it this
way. Okay.
Yeah,
I love
perfect.
It.
Perfect. So I had that company for 6 years. And it, as I said, it was very, very hard business. And I had a terrific book, and I had 2 or 3 of the world's most important importers that are broker importers, and it made my book very attractive. And so I was made an offer, and I sold the company, and I was delighted to sell the company because I'd had enough of it, and I'd done all the looking around, you know, the other way that I needed to do. But when I sold that, it was like, okay, well, what now? And in the 2 big books that I had, they both made Grenache from the south of France and the north of Spain. And I really fell in love with Grenache. I'm a Pinot girl. I've been doing Pinot Noir my entire professional career. And Grenache has some similarities. So while I stayed married to Pinot Noir, I did have a little fling with Grenache. And
everybody needs a little, well, not everybody, needs a little side thing.
Everybody but my husband needs.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
A side thing.
Yes. Yeah. That's a whole different story.
Yeah, that's a totally different story. Yeah, and it's probably wine with an H, but in any case, I said, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to go explore the world of Grenache. So for the first time in my life since I was 18 years old, I did not have a job. And
how did that feel?
Oh,
because I'm terrified of that point.
Oh, no, I am so not terrified of it. And so I took a credit card, maps. We were doing maps, 2010, and rented a car and off I went. I was there for 4 months. David came over twice to join me along the way, once in France, once in Spain. And as I did all that, I ended up working, as I said, I couldn't run away and work in the circus again till I was almost 50 years old. And I ended up working in Châteauneuf-du-Pape. And then I ended up working in the very south in the Roussillon. So I was literally able at that age to be able to go over there and work harvest. I was an intern and I didn't make any money. I had room and board.
Was it good to kind of revisit those roots though?
Oh, it was so fun and getting up every morning and walking in and getting in the winery. And of course it was such a different environment because it was a French winery. They literally stop and say good morning to everybody. You have to stop and go look you in the eye and say, Heidi, good morning. He'd do the double, triple kiss, whatever their tradition is where you are. And then you can go to work. But you don't go in and go to work without literally stopping and saying good morning to everybody.
I love that.
It's so lovely. It just changes the morning. It's so great.
It does. You feel appreciated.
You do.
Recognized.
And you're a team. The team. Everybody just said hello to each other. You're a team now. Everybody's already talked, you know. So anyway, it was a moving experience. And I went back and I did it in 11 and 12 too. So I loved it so much. So I went back. I did it 3 years. And in the end of all that, I ended up down in the Roussillon, close to a number of people. In fact, one of the gals is married to a Swiss, and they have a winery there, and she's from Lake Oswego. So that was a fun connection at one time. But another couple that I met, with whom I literally had dinner in Paris with last week, we're so close, and they're my quote-unquote partners. We're not financial business partners that way. We're partners. And I ended up buying two small little vineyard sites. And so, you know, altogether we're like 5 acres. I mean, it's nothing big here, but these are old vines, 65, 75, 85 year old grapevines.
That's amazing.
And they're just little canes that sort of come up 3 inches off the ground and then fall over. I mean, they give you two or three clusters, you know, per grapevine. But it's old vine Grenache and it's super fun. And I do that project with the Calvés.
That's amazing.
Yep. So that's the story of that vineyard.
Okay. Well, I love it. Okay. Circling back. We're done harvesting and interning now. And how does Jackson family come into this whole picture?
Yeah, that was sort of a fun story. And it was complete kismet, which, of course, is the greatest thing. Now, I have to take a sip of this Chardonnay.
Please do, because it is absolutely phenomenal.
We're drinking the Grand Marais, probably 2020 Chardonnay. Can't quite read the label, but I think that's...
Whatever it is, is absolutely stunning. And we will have pictures of it for sure. So we'll get the right year.
Thank you very much. So when I was back after 2012, I ended up being grabbed to manage the Four Graces through a sale. And it was sad. The owners were finally getting a divorce and they literally had to now move this asset along. And I was hired to run the company and put together a portfolio and turn around and sell it. And the whole thing took 15 months from doing the five-year plan, finding the broker, finding the buyer, blah, blah, blah. And in the middle of all that, in late 2012, early 2013, Jackson family invested in Oregon. And there was a company called Premium Pacific, and they ended up developing 7 different sites up here in Oregon. And they also developed sites down in Napa Valley. And Barbara Banky, sole proprietor, basically, of Jackson Family Wines, who was a real estate lawyer and understands real estate, now understands vineyards all these years later. I would suspect that she's seen more vineyards around the world than any single human being on the planet because people are offering her things to buy all the time. In any case, she was looking at this stuff in Napa Valley, and they said, well, you have to take it all. Well, as you know, the person with the checkbook actually gets to determine that at the end of the day.
For sure.
But she had been intrigued with Oregon, and Jess Jackson was not intrigued with Oregon because we have no flexibility up here. You can get 3 tons of the acre, then 2.5 tons of the acre, now 3 tons of the acre, and you can do one thing, and that's make great wine. You know, you don't have a lot of flexibility, and you can't just grow the Merlot next to the Pinot that's next to the Cab that's next to the Chardonnay. I mean, we're at the northern edge of ripening Pinot Noir, and it's a much finer line that you have to ride when you're making wine here in the Willamette Valley. So Jess was never particularly excited about it, but Barbara always was intrigued. So when this real estate offer came up, they had these properties up here. And she said, yeah, let's go look at them. And they literally got up here and stepped out of the car at Grand Marais. And she said, holy moly, I'll take this. What else do you have? And they went down to Zena Crown. And so in one afternoon, she basically picked up those two vineyards and a third property called Maple Grove.
That's a big pickup.
It's a big pickup.
It's a good day.
For
her.
It was a real good day for her. She just loves Oregon. I mean, she loves Oregon. It's so fun. We're like her little favorite child. And I just said that publicly, and the rest of the company's just going to shoot me. But she really does love Oregon. It's very sweet. So she ended up buying those properties. And then next was, oh gosh, well, now we have to make some wine. And it's important to remember that those properties are large. Like Grand Moraine is 194 planted acres. Xenocron.
A lot of vineyard.
That's correct. So a very few businesses could actually buy a piece of property of that size, then find a way to make it into wine, and then most importantly, sell it. So there weren't a lot of potential buyers for something like that. But it's important to recognize that those properties were on the market for 2.5 years or so, and with no movement or action at all until Jackson Family made their first purchases. And then the other properties were all sold within the next 3 months. Just bang. It was like, okay, those are really good things. Let's get going here.
She kind of started the ball rolling.
She started the ball rolling. And Domaine Duran bought one. And who bought Willekiah? The people up from Washington. Elk Cove bought the smallest one, which was 35 acres. So and the rest were bigger than that. So that to your point, that really started it rolling. So the next purchase was the Grand Moraine Winery, which was the Selena Winery, was where Laurent was making Selena. And he moved that brand over to his other winery because we did not buy the brand. Laurent still owns that brand and started making wine there in 13. We actually shared it with Laurent and a couple other custom winemakers. And then by 14, we had it ourselves. So that was the first winemaking was Grand Moraine. And that's where I came in. So back to the story of a little bit of serendipity, David and I were out to dinner with a gentleman who was actually the broker for the project. And he was telling us about working with Jackson Family and blah, blah. And David, being who he is, the King Pied Piper of the Willamette Valley, he says—
Does he know he has that title?
No, he doesn't, because I just made it up. It's a little like Micro Geek.
But you're on a roll today.
Yeah, I know. So he, I think it's the audience, or no, the not the audience. What are you? My co-host.
Cohort.
My cohort, co-host. There you go. And anyway, he right away says, well, we need to invite them over for lunch. This is very important that they're coming into the Willamette Valley. We need to welcome them into the Willamette Valley. We need to help them know who to call and what to do and where to go. And we can't just let these people come here without, you know, the welcome wagon. So we gave that message to the broker. He took it back to the lawyer that he was working with at JFW. And fast forward 2 months or whatever, and we had Barbara and her daughter, Katie. Rick Tigner is the president, CEO, and still is to this day, the COO at the time, our government affairs person. Anyway, we had this beautiful lunch at Adelsheim and took them through the winery and opened some very old wines so that they could see that this was something that was very much a part of winemaking in the Willamette Valley, that wines really do age. We're going to show you what we mean. So you would pull out a 30-year-old Pinot Noir and they're aghast, of course. And in the course of that, we were talking about I was asked about me and what I was doing and blah, blah, blah. And it happens that many years ago when Jackson Family were trying to build the La Crema Winery, it was next door to my family ranch, the one I grew up on, the one we started this entire conversation with.
Eugene's Ranch,
the Slusser Ranch. And there they're building it next door. And the whole neighborhood went up in arms. There were no wineries. Again, you know, this is 1980 or something. No, it's later than that. And so Jess was very accommodating, and he made a lot of changes in the building. And if you go by there now, it's very, very low and sleek. It's very hard to see, and you definitely don't know how big it is when you drive by it. So he was very good about accommodating the neighborhood. But there was one couple that really were unhappy and continued to be very vocal about their unhappiness. It happened to be my aunt and uncle.
Right. You know, but there has to be somebody.
So I'm telling this story at lunch, forgetting this, that I'm that family. I don't know what I was forgetting, but I'm going down this pathway and I can see David looking at me with this look of, where are you going with this story? And I said, but there was one couple that was really, oh my, and they were my aunt and uncle. And I think the story's over now. Right. As I sort of folded into myself. And Barbara is so, she's a really terrific person. And she turns around and she said, well, that's ancient history. We've got the winery. We're happy. You know, where are they? So it was very cute. And on we went. Anyway, fast forward one day, they get home they go to the office the next day and they run into a guy named Fred Reno, who I had known for a very long time and had worked with in distribution. And in the early 80s, I had worked with him. So I'd known him a very long time. And Fred was working with Jackson Family. And he said, and he and I ended up owning the distribution company together that I sold. That's how closely I knew him. And we had done business together. And he said, so did you meet Eugenia? And they said, yes. He said, and you hired her, right? And they're like, what are you talking about? And he said, you hired her to be the winemaker and general manager at Grand Marnier, right? Yesterday you did that? And they looked at him like, why would we do that? And anyway, I got a call the next day and that's what ended up happening.
And there you are.
And there I am. That's how I started with Jackson Family. And that was July of 13.
I asked you this when you were here and I just wanted to, you know, make sure that it was okay that I asked this question, because when Jackson Family came in, and I still hear it, you know, kind of in scuttle, you know, people are like, oh my God, Jackson Family, you know, just the negativity of it. But there's so much positivity that has come out of Jackson Family being in the Willamette Valley. And if you could touch on just that really quickly, because I want to, there's always naysayers and yep. They're the ones that never want change. They're the ones that when there's a red light blinking and it should be solid, they're, you know, pissed off about it. So tell me the benefits and the beauty and the positivity and the greatness that Barbara and Jackson Family have brought to the area.
Heidi, thank you for that question. I really appreciate the opportunity to share that. When they arrived, I think, of course, the first thing most people know Kendall Jackson.
Yes.
And we have a joke that when you don't know us, you call us Kendall Jackson. And then when you know who we are, you call us Jackson Family. Kendall Jackson is just one of the brands. Now, mind you, it's the biggest brand.
It's a big brand.
It's the foundation brand. It's the cash brand. It's what allows us to do all this other stuff that we're doing. That and our second largest brand, La Crema. They are incredibly strong brands. COVID, if nothing showed us that, COVID did. You know, they grew during COVID because it was such a retail moment in time. But there are 48 other wineries in the portfolio for Jackson Family Wines.
Did you say 48?
I did.
So
we have about 50 estates around the world altogether. And that's what we do. We're in the grape growing winemaking business. That's who we are. That's what we do. We don't really do anything besides that. And we work really, really hard to do it well. So when it became sort of common thinking that what we were going to do was make an inexpensive Kendall Jackson Pinot Noir from the Willamette Valley, which was the farthest thing from anybody's mind. Barbara was all about, she understood and appreciated what we had done, which was a higher price point. She was completely aware of the business opportunity that the Willamette Valley had created by having a price point that's $10, $12 more a bottle than the counterparts in certain parts of California. So she saw it as a very different concept, and that is her vision in a nutshell, is owning some of the greatest wine estates in the world. It's just that, it's kind of that simple.
So she's bought some dandies up here for sure.
And she's bought some dandies, and she's doing that all over the world, and she's not done. You know, she continues to grow. We continue to grow. So I think people were quite suspicious of us until really the turning point was when we released our first Grand Marnier wine, and it came out at $45 a bottle. It was in this very elegant package that you see here. It was high quality, small volume, and it was just what everybody else was doing. And it was like, oh, you're not trying to change the neighborhood. We're like, no, we're trying to join the neighborhood. You guys are doing it well. We'd like to do it well right alongside you. So I think that helped. That settled the, what are their business motives up here? I think that was number one. And then number two, Jackson Family has moved to enough other places over time that they understand that it's the culture of that community that has to drive everything you do, which is why they wanted somebody from Oregon in this, running this company. They want you to say, really cool, but that's actually not the way we do it in the Willamette Valley. And we actually, the executives now say, and we're going to do so and so and so. Well, except in Oregon, of course, where we do it differently. And then they go right on. They don't say what differently. They just have learned that they need to always remember to add the caveat that except in Oregon, where they do it differently.
Kind of a little redheaded stepchild
it
up
is,
here.
It is. Yes. It is so much.
Middle child syndrome, maybe yep. To an extent. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and that's exactly what I say, Heidi. I say that being in Oregon is like being in college. You have mom and dad's checkbook, but they never know if you came home at night.
There you go.
Right. In a nutshell, it's that. It's, so it is. We get, you know, we're just enough away that we have a level of independence, and that's really fun. And they respect that because they know that we are going to do what are the company pillars and values and ethos, but within the vocabulary of where we live, which is really stunning. And then fast forward to the fact that we do have a pretty good checkbook, and they are very, very generous when it comes to the community. So a great example was, I said I started in July of 13. I get a call in December of 13 from a lovely gal who's one of Barbara's assistants, and she said, I need you to help me with this giving project. And I'm like, what are you talking about? She said, well, you know, Barbara has her own personal giving that's alongside what we do at Jackson Family Wines. And now that you're a new member of the family, we'd like to be able to contribute to Oregon, but we need your help to tell us where to go. And so I had guidelines, and a lot of it's about family violence, food security, home security, a lot of, about it, women and that sort of thing, because this is Barbara's personal giving, supposed to the company. And I was in tears. I was like, you want me to help you give Barbara's money away? Is that what you're asking me to do? And she said, yes, that's what we're asking you to do. And if you could give us 5 to 8 different potentials, then we'll do the research, and then we'll come back to you and tell you what we've decided to do before we do it. And I'm like, well, okay, thank you. welcome to Jackson Family Wines, I think. And then it all transpired. Oh my God, Heidi, you should have seen the phone calls and the notes and things that I received afterwards, because these were substantial contributions and they translated into real meaningful acts of kindness and support and help. And that's who this company is. And it's been that way all 10 years since that.
That's amazing. And thank you for answering that question, because to me, it's a big question. And I think it just, again, quiets kind of the floating negativity that people just can't seem to release sometimes. So,
well, and also there's additional family business here in McMinnville that is not part of Jackson Family Wines. And, you know, people get them all confused and they don't know who's doing what or who to call. And, you know, so it's good that I'm visible enough that I often get the call so that I can direct them to the person who can actually help them with their problem instead of being frustrated by a large company that you can't get a hold of anybody.
There you go. I like it. Okay. Let's switch to wine, like actual wine, because, okay, you know, we only have so much time and there's a lot of story that you have given us in the last, you know, how many ever years of your life to where you're at now. So we started with Bubbles and we've been really talking about food pairings. And so we had a very specific order for our chef today.
We did.
Yes, because we both are mega fans of Dustin's gluten-free fried chicken. It's so freaking good.
It's a thing. Yeah. And the thing that's so cool about it is because Dustin does a lot of work with us, biscuits and pickles, and he does a lot of our harvest meals and our events and things. So he's an old friend and collaborator. And we have decided that the Grammarain Blanc de Blanc, which is pretty, it's 100% Chardonnay, it's a bit austere, and it is the perfect, perfect balance to this fried chicken. And so when you said Dustin fried chicken, I said Blanc de Blanc. So
and that, your face lit up like a Christmas tree when I said Dustin's bringing food.
Well, who gets to make it like an afternoon where you get Bubbles and fried chicken and that's quote, I'm at work, Heidi.
Oh, amen, sister. Amen. Yes, I am too. On so many levels. But I get fried chicken and Bubbles, and then you've brought these other wines as well. So, okay, so with fried chicken, we're pairing Blanc de Blanc. Why?
Because of sort of the sweet, fatty flavor that you get from the chicken, particularly the chicken skin, of course, and the Bubbles is high in acid and it's got that real lean finish. So it's a real compliment to a fatty food like that.
I cannot wait, honestly.
And in fact, just so you know, it reduces the fat grams by half and the calories by 90%.
Oh my God, this is like the best day ever. Yeah. I had no idea that even existed.
Yeah, no, it does. And it's something that you just need to put into your daily day routine.
Every dietitian on the planet needed to hear that.
And, they did.
There you go. Oh. From the words of Eugenia, less calories, less fat. As long as you're drinking Chardonnay, Bubbles.
Chardonnay base, Blanc de Blanc.
There you go. I had the Chardonnay right. Yep. The Blanc de Blanc with fried chicken.
Yep, you're good.
Yep,
you're
okay.
good to go.
And just for a massive plug for Dustin, I request the fried chicken as much as possible because it is so freaking good.
It is. And it's been very rude of you to make me look at it most of this time. But
And smell it.
And smell it. But the time will come.
Yeah. It will. So soon. So soon. We've moved on to the Pinot Noir, which we'll talk about in a second, but you said something, well, you've said so many things that have broken every rule in the book. Yes. Yeah, no. Keep on spouting. But the thing that cracked me up when we were talking about wine and just drinking out of certain things is that you said that you like to take a drink of wine, taste it, swirl it, do all the winemaking things, and then you add ice to your glass.
I will.
That breaks every winemaker's rule ever.
I don't know that it really does, but it certainly breaks the rules that we have been told and that we spout. And in fact, somebody just showed me a new gadget that's about something that will keep your wine cold the whole time, blah, blah, blah. And I did that. I said, that's great for keeping your wine cold, but where's the dilution effect, which is the ice? And really for me, it's a combination. Sometimes wines are just too intense. And wine needs to be appreciated ultimately as a beverage. And the whole spectrum, all the way from I'm thirsty and I want something cool and refreshing, so I'm going to put a little ice in my rosé, all the way to I'm going to sit here with this glass of $75 Pinot Noir and I'm going to savor it for the next hour and a half while I'm figuring it out. Wine gets to be all those things. Wine doesn't have to be one thing.
So is it sacrilegious to throw some bubbly soda in it and make it a spritzer?
Oh, I used to do that all the time. Not a flavored spritzer.
No, bubbles and a little bit of dilution.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I used to do that all the time, but I don't drink sparkling water anymore. So they're not little spritzers. They're just wine with ice. Yeah, they're no longer have a cute little name like spritzer.
We've come up with everything else today.
We'll come up with a name
by the time we're done eating and drinking. Yeah. Well, we have three bottles of wine to drink through, so we'll be so creative by the time we're done with this.
Oh, yeah, we will.
We'll both need rides.
We won't remember how creative we were, but we'll be creative.
No. Okay, so let's talk about what you've brought on the table, because Chardonnay is it's been around. And it's been a thing in Oregon for a while, but it's really gaining some traction.
Yeah.
What's so unique and different about Chardonnay? Because so many times I hear from people that are friends of mine they'll comment on social medias, I don't like Chardonnay. But they have in their mind that Chardonnay is very much one-dimensional, one box. And people in California, please don't hate me, but it's that California style of Chardonnay.
Yeah, I'm going to go there with you because you're spot on about this. When Oregon was first planted, the Willamette Valley was first planted, it was sort of a third, a third, a third between Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, and Riesling. We know where Pinot Noir has gone, and now it's 65%. Obviously, it's been a hit. Riesling has fallen aside because of the market, et cetera. And Chardonnay, some of the early Chardonnays, and they were made with clones that came up from California. The Pinot Noir clones that came up from California have translated exceptionally well, and then we've added to that. But the clone, we called it 108, they call it 4 in California, 4 or 5, that came up, and it really didn't ripen properly up here. But having said that, in 1992, I think it was, the Tualatin 1987 or 88 Chardonnay was on the top 100. And people don't realize that, but it was made by Bill Fuller. Bill Fuller was a properly trained winemaker. He made wine in California. He had a winemaking degree. And he came up here and made this wine. And the comments on it are just amazing. And a couple things happened. And one certainly is clonal in bringing in the new clones that were brought in by David Adelson.
Look at that.
Yeah, thank you, Dr. Clone. So that was a part of it. Those were the Dijon, what are called the Dijon clones. But the other part of it was learning how to make wine, Chardonnay, in Oregon, like an Oregon product, like a Willamette Valley product. And the real thing that stopped the Chardonnays from the Willamette Valley was that the accepted New World Chardonnay came out of California, and this is the best irony of the whole story. It was based on the Kendall Jackson Vintner's Reserve, which is a big, oaky, buttery, bombastic wine. Now, it's not like that anymore because it too has evolved with the marketplace. But it was very oaked and a little bit of sweetness and what people were looking for. And now it has less oak and less sweetness. And, you know, it's evolved with the wine drinker demographic at the same time. But that was what the consumer and the trade thought a New World Chardonnay was supposed to taste like. So the stuff coming out of Oregon was just an oxymoron. Nobody had any idea what this stuff was. It was austere and blah, blah. So now you fast forward to a combination of warmer climate, new clonal material, new group of winemakers who are going to make Willamette Valley Chardonnay. They're going to throw away everything they know from California and start over. And then finally, the evolution of the trade and the consumer. So these things all happened at the same time or, you know, over a period of time. So the when we were ready to show these wines, the trade was ready to accept them. They, too, wanted something different than that style of wine. And the Californians have had to evolve. They've had to change their style of wine to fit the marketplace. So if you were to compare them today from 15 years ago, it's quite a different wine, which is why they continue to sell, because they are, you know, they are keeping up to date.
I've tried some of them and it's still a little bit different from what my palate wants. And there's nothing wrong with that. But if you have not tried Willamette Valley Chardonnay in more than one, because everybody makes it differently, each site is going to be different. It's going to speak to where it's grown, how it's made, whatever. You have got to throw away your ABC, you know, whatever it is. I don't drink Chardonnay.
Right.
Or anything
right.
But Chardonnay, I guess, is right. What the acronym is for.
Right.
And step up to the plate and start enjoying it, because it's sensational on so many levels. And Pinot Noir is still the king of Oregon, and there's nothing wrong with that. You can get really pinoted out really fast. And there's other things to drink. And there's other things that are coming.
And there's so much stuff coming, too.
Yes.
That's the other thing.
And we could spend 3 more hours on all of this because there's just so much to talk about. But do it. Just step up to the plate. Pour a lovely large glass of Chardonnay. I had some the other night. French Chardonnay. It's Willamette Valley French made Chardonnay. And oh my God. I've had the whole bottle myself. Oh, luckily, my husband doesn't think he likes Chardonnay, and I'm not.
And you're not
I'm not working
that.
On trading
yeah.
his mind.
Yeah.
yeah.
No, as
yeah.
long as there's something else open for him.
Yes.
Well, and the beauty of it is that one of the things we learned is that there's so much sun in California that when the grapes get to the kind of ripeness, mostly the tannins are no longer green and certain things like that, they have more sugar and therefore more alcohol. And we're so fortunate that we get all that stuff because we're not looking for that same tropical fruit sort of thing, that fruit cocktail kind of thing. Then we're picking at 20, 21 Brix. They're picking at 24, 25, 26.
Yikes.
So you can just see the alcohol variation
for sure.
Right there. And that changes the equation right from the get-go. And to your point, and these are fabulous with foods. I mean, a huge range of foods, but we make them differently. We leave them in barrel longer. We make them much more in the winemaking flow of white Burgundy rather than California Chardonnay.
This has been phenomenal. Like, I knew this was going to be a great show, but this has just been way beyond expectations. And I guess I shouldn't have even had an expectation of what today was going to be, other than I knew I was going to have a great time. We're going to drink great wine. Destin was bringing fried chicken. And
I'm not sure we need much else.
And
huh?
I get to hang out with you because I think I told you that you're probably my next best friend. Maybe we have a little bit of an age gap, but it's really not that much. And who cares about the numbers? So
who cares about the
I'm
numbers?
Coming over for the next butter tasting. Just
that sounds perfect.
So you know.
So I was in Healdsburg last night or the night before. I was down there for just a day. And I was in this quite fancy hotel, and a sixsome came in, real wine people, serious wine people. I mean, they'd gone to 4 wineries, and they joined clubs, and, you know, all the things that we love. I'm like, oh, come visit our wineries. We like you. But right away, I said, oh, yeah, they're older. And then I thought, no, they're in their 50s, aren't they? No, they're not.
Whoops.
Hey, whoops, right. Whoops. You know, that whole thing of, well, as soon as I get to be 35— then all I feel right. It's so funny. You just don't have any perception that you're older.
No, I'm pretty sure I'm still 30.
Yeah.
But with a much more mature mind.
Yeah.
And experiences behind me.
Yeah. So, yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. Yeah.
No, I'm doing the same thing. So I get it. So, yeah. Eugenia, this has been beyond fabulous. Thank you so, so, so much for coming in and hanging out with us. And we're going to go eat some chicken.
We're going to go eat some chicken. We're going to drink some more wine.
Yes. And we're going to bullshit a whole lot more because we got a lot more to catch up on.
Yes, we do. So, Heidi, thank you. This has been a real treat today.
Well, I'm glad. And I'm hoping that your PR department doesn't blackball both of us for whatever we may or may not have said.
Yeah, I hope not too. Let's just keep the recording from them for a while.
Okay, we got a couple weeks.
Yeah,
for sure.
For sure, for sure. Yeah.
Well, a huge thank you today for everybody for listening. If you caught this episode, you definitely caught a gem. Daniel with South of Autumn Productions, he always makes us sound great and takes out all of our extra words that we don't mean to say. Dustin with Biscuit and Pickles, we have praised your everything, my friend. The fried chicken, the food. We have a whole smorgasbord of stuff to enjoy out there. So make sure and look him up for your next catering event. And as always, please like, share, subscribe, and follow us on socials because that's really important as well. So cheers, y'all. Pour another glass of wine.